situation in our town.
We're going to continue this discussion and post it online at democracynow.org. I want to thank you, Andy Timoner, director of All the Walls Came Down, the film shortlisted for an Oscar, features Heavenly Hughes, who founded My Tribe Rise. That does it for the show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, online and archived at KFAI.org, the community's true voice.
Welcome to Mini Culture Presents. I'm Micah Whetstone, and today we are going to be continuing to air our series, Mini Culture's Year in Review for 2025. If you missed last week's show, you can find it in the archives at kfai.org, or you can always visit Mini Culture's SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/miniculture, where you can hear and share stories individually and pass them along to others who you think should hear it, which might even be everybody in your address book. This afternoon, I've got some more great Mini Culture stories on tap, and we're going to begin with one by Britt Ahmet about Bob Dylan coming here to re-record some songs for his Blood on the Tracks record, an album which turned 50 last year, about half of which was cut right here in the Twin Cities by Minnesota musicians. That story by Britt was passed around and forwarded on quite a bit this year. And if you would like to share it with your friends after hearing it, visit soundcloud.com/miniculture, and you too can spread the word. Today we're also going to hear stories produced by creators Arme Rivard, poetry, science, and wrestling host Paul Broha, Angela Lundberg, and Allison Young about cross-country ski racing, cat behavior consultants, you heard me right, and perhaps equally unlikely, troll hunting adventures. All of these stories are from Mini Culture producers around our great state exploring Minnesota's art, culture, and history with editing, guidance, and expertise from our director and executive producers, Julie Sansulo and Erica Yannick. But first, here is the Mini Culture story, Tangled Up in Bob.
You are listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. This year, 2025, marks the 50th anniversary of Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks. The 1975 album has strong Minnesota connections. Not only was half of it re-recorded at the last minute at the local Sound 80 studio, but Dylan also hired local musicians to rework five songs on the album that he hoped would be his commercial comeback. KFAI producer Britt Ahmet tells the story of these Minneapolis recordings.
Kevin Odegaard wanted to watch TV. It was December 1974, and he was holed up with his favorite Thursday night crime drama, Kojak. But then the phone started ringing.
I just let it ring because I thought for sure it was a crew call.
He was a brakeman for the Chicago Northwestern Railroad. He could use the shift, but no way was he giving up his sofa to freeze his butt on the rails.
Finally, when the show ended and Kojak said, "Who loves you, baby?" I picked up. It was David Zimmerman.
Odegaard's other life was as a Minneapolis musician, and Zimmerman was his manager. But more importantly, for this story, David Zimmerman was Bob Dylan's younger brother.
He wanted a small-bodied Martin guitar. He was asking for a gut string model from the 30s. Oh, that's a tall order.
Being a musician, Odegaard knew his way around the local music shops. He knew just the dealer to call, and he knew just who the Martin was for.
I started to understand that Bob was standing behind him, breathing down his neck, because he wanted this guitar.
Odegaard called the dealer, who happened to have almost the exact guitar on consignment. But what was Dylan doing in Minnesota? In 1961, Dylan had hitched a ride out of Minnesota to find fame and fortune as a New York folkie and international rock star. So the fact that he had returned
started this amazing handful of days in Minneapolis at Sound 80.
Paul Metza is the co-author of Blood in the Tracks, the Minnesota musicians behind Dylan's masterpiece. The book details the re-recording of five tracks on an album Dylan had promised for Christmas 1974, but delayed because he didn't like the recordings he'd made a few months before in New York with top-notch session musicians. It had been nearly a decade since anything Bob Dylan put out had felt relevant. And that was beginning to bother the guy who'd once been hailed as the voice of the 1960s generation.
Dylan was looking to make a commercial comeback.
Rick Shevchik is Metz's co-author.
In the mid-60s, it had gotten too much for him, and he intentionally withdrew, but he was starting to sort of creep back into public consciousness. He was really searching for where he wanted to be and who he wanted to be at that stage. And he wrote a batch of songs that were among the best that he'd ever written.
Dylan had written these songs on his Martin guitar, but it was stolen. That's why his brother called Odegaard during Kojak, and why the next night, the guitarist and sometime railroad brakeman found himself at Sound 80, one of Minneapolis's preeminent recording studios, with the replacement Martin and Bob Dylan.
Strangely enough, nobody was nervous. There were a couple of double takes.
Also in attendance were a handful of local musicians.
They weren't just garage band musicians or pickup musicians. These were the best musicians in Minnesota.
These pros, Metza says, got right to work, banging out a new version of a song called Idiot Wind. The New York version felt laid back. This one got right in your face with an edge that cut. Dylan liked it so much, he had them do another song and then called them back on Monday to do three more. Odegaard hadn't been brought in to play. He was there because of the Martin. So he sat out the first session. But the second night, he got his chance.
Let's just, yeah.
Dylan was in a relaxed mood.
He was with his homeboys in Minneapolis. He wasn't with a bunch of studio hotshots with New York City.
He played through a song in the key of G. Then Odegaard and the band played through it.
But afterward, it was kind of dead air. And Bob is right there in front of me. And he said, so what'd you think? And I was too relaxed, so I told him the truth. I said, it's passable. It's fine the way it is, but he said, but what?
Odegaard suggested moving the key to A, to Bob Dylan, the icon, the future Nobel laureate. Dylan studied the floor for a second, then
looked up and said, yeah, okay, yeah, let's give it a try.
The engineer hit record, and that live take of Tangled Up in Blue, along with the other Minnesota re-recordings, made it on Bob Dylan's January 1975 release, Blood on the Tracks, the album that succeeded in putting him back on top. Yet ever since that time, critics and fans have been divided. Were the New York or Minnesota recordings better? In 2018, Dylan released all the versions on More Blood, More Tracks, but that didn't end the debate. Co-authors Rick Shevchik and Paul Metza say one answer may rest in the original album's enduring popularity.
I have to be honest that I just don't think Blood on the Tracks would have been anywhere near as successful if they had stuck to just the New York recordings. I think that the five re-recordings in Minneapolis is what made it a great album.
It's not only one of Dylan's greatest records, it's one of the greatest rock and roll records of all time.
As for Kevin Odegaard, who just wanted to stay and watch Kojak, those 2 days forever attached his name to that of Bob Dylan, which is okay for this guitarist.
People say this and that about Bob, but I love Bob. I've been happy to live in his shadow for 50 years.
For KFAI, this is Britt Ahmet.
You've been listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Support for Miniculture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on the KFAI website or go to kfai.org/minneculture. Last July, a stray cat showed up at producer Britt Ahmet's house. Britt took him in and named him Honey, but Honey was anything but sweet with her other two cats. She didn't want to rehome him, so she decided to call Joey Lisvardi, a Twin Cities-based cat behavior consultant who runs Class Act Cats. With Joey's help, Britt hopes this cat tale has a happy ending. Here's Britt with more.
It started off innocently enough.
Are you hungry?
Late July, this cat shows up, all skin and bones. I mean, so scrawny, his ears looked like they belonged to a cat three times his size. But he kept showing up. So I gave him a name.
Honey, here's your food.
Honey for the honey-colored spots and tail on this otherwise white kitty. At first, he wouldn't let me near him, but eventually he graduated to visiting inside the house, to playing with me, to letting me pet him. Finally, in December, I took the plunge. I brought him to the vet for neutering, where I was told Honey had won the award for most parasites in a single cat at their office. The vet seemed pleased with this. But no wonder he'd been so shabby and skinny looking.
There you go.
I should probably back up and tell you something. I already had two cats when Honey showed up, Timber and Finn. They tolerated this new cat, even if they liked to boss him around a little. There were some snarls, some swats, pretty tame stuff. But oh boy, that was about to change. A now healthy and happily domestic Honey had turned into a bully. He looked like that nerd in school after a summer of hitting the weight room and pounding protein shakes. And he'd gotten an attitude, too. I was spending all day keeping Honey from pouncing and ripping the other two to shreds. I'm thinking, oh, God, was I going to have to rehome this guy? I didn't want to. But so I contacted Joey Lisvardi.
I run Class Act Cats, where I help people who have cat behavior problems, ranging from aggression towards humans to aggression between cats. I see a lot of aggression and litter box issues. And I also help people with training because, yes, cats can be trained. Contrary to the myth out there that they're not trainable, they're actually very trainable.
Lisvardi is a Twin Cities-based, certified cat behavior consultant. He got into the field because, at one time, he too had an aggression problem with his cat, Zoloft.
I was working a job that I'd leave the house before the sun would rise, and I'd come home after the sun would set, and I wouldn't see the sun. And I would feed Zoloft, and I would go to sleep, and I didn't feel like doing much, and I was super burnt out. I wasn't playing with him. I wasn't paying attention to him. And he started developing these weird episodes. He would kind of follow me around and he would curl his tail in. And then he would make this very, very just distressed sounding noise and he would bite me. I started becoming scared because I was like, I don't know what to do.
He came to realize that Zoloft was acting out of frustration. There was a reason for his behavior, and Lisvardi figured out he had to change his behavior too if he was going to help his cat. This also led him down the line to decide to get trained and certified as a cat behavior consultant. At our first session, I unloaded on him.
This cat that I'm so impressed with, he's getting so healthy,
But the problem is that he will go after the other cats like a heat-seeking missile.
Mm-hmm.
They'll turn their back, and he's like a street brawler. I mean, I've actually seen fur fly.
A lot of behavior concerns are going to come down to fear or anxiety or stress, which are variations of similar emotions. But the cat is feeling threatened that these other cats are going to harm them in some way, or they're going to steal their food, or they're going to take away something from them, or that they might hurt them. And
very real.
Yeah. And the other part of it, too, is it sounds like in your case, socialization, where this new cat may not have had a lot of experience with other cats, or may have had really bad experiences with other cats, which can make it very, very challenging to get them to be like, hey, this other cat is not a threat.
He gave me homework, and there were no spray bottles involved, which is usually the advice you get on the internet. For the first couple weeks, I pretty much had to keep the dudes in separate parts of the house.
There's Timber.
But in the long term, that wasn't going to work.
What do you think of having honey in the house?
So mostly I just let them go where they wanted to. But I had to pay attention and get there before honey started to pounce. Taking Lozvardi's advice, I would hold up a blanket or a pillow between honey and what other cat he was aggressing against. And then calmly, I would redirect honey's energy into something else. And actually, it worked. But let me just say right here, it took a lot of time and effort, and it still does. But only a month in my follow-up session with Joey Lozvardi, I was able to report that Honey had not beaten the fluff out of Timber or Finn in almost 2 weeks.
Oh, Honey. I hear you're doing better, Honey.
We're not perfect yet.
There's Fifi McGee. There's Honey.
But we're working on it.
No fighting, huh? Nope.
This is Brenomet for KFAI.
You are listening to Miniculture on KFAI. For many Minnesota athletes, it's all about the distance. From runners who take on the Twin Cities or Duluth Marathons, to cross-country skiers who traverse 50 kilometers for the American Birkebeiner in Wisconsin. There's something special about a long-distance race and the communities that these races attract. Just a few weeks ago, a 100-kilometer ski race was added to the Midwest's long list of long-distance races. The Ski North Ultra Marathon, which happened in early March, is a 62-mile cross-country ski course. KFAI's Paul Broha set off with a crew of assistant producers to watch the first Ski North Ultra and to meet some of the people who spent their whole day skiing through the woods in northern Minnesota.
How are you guys feeling?
Excited for a day in the woods.
Yeah, it should be great. Yeah, it should be fun, you know?
There's some moose tracks out there.
Really?
We saw moose tracks around the 40K mark.
Oh, here we go!
It's a Saturday morning, early March, on Minnesota's north shore of Lake Superior. 71 skiers just left the starting area near some campsites at Cascade River State Park. The snow is actually too thin in this area to mechanically groom the trails. It's been thawing and freezing. It's crusty. No one seems to mind.
How do you feel?
Oh, really good.
Beautiful.
I'm doing great, actually.
Pure joy.
Just a few days before this 100-kilometer Ski North Ultra Marathon, race director Allie Ricken wasn't quite sure if the full course would be skiable or if the race would even actually happen. A late-season dump of snow in the Twin Cities completely missed the North Shore, but the little snow there was at Cascade River just barely held out on the rocky trails, and Allie got friends and family to patch up some of the dicey parts with shovels and pickaxes.
So you're saying there is some snow out there?
Yep, it is starting to melt, though.
You think it'll stay enough for tomorrow's race?
Hopefully.
That's my sweetheart, Ingrid, speaking with Allie's daughter, Rosemary, while her dad was chipping ice off some wooden steps. All of my kids are here, too. Ingrid's skiing in the race, and Allie is a good friend of ours. She talked to me earlier about some of the adventurous aspects of this course.
When I was originally planning this, I got a good chuckle because it says, you know, ski trail across the waterfall bridge. But then I went there. There's stairs. So that's a walk across. People will have to take their skis off unless they're really want to
bring your stair skis.
That would wreck your skis.
The night before the race, Allie went over the maps with some of her volunteers.
If you go a little bit further straight, you'll run into a loop that should, it's not groomed, but it hopefully looks like a skiable situation.
Saturday morning started at about 14 degrees, which made for some great beardicles on the folks with facial hair and frozen eyelashes all around. I caught up with the pack about 10 kilometers in at the first rest stop.
How's the traffic coming?
It's pretty good, yeah. I think by this point it's a little more relaxed.
It started to snow and felt like a Christmas card as skiers disappeared up the narrow trail with just one set of ski tracks. This race was set up to finish mostly in the daylight. That's a little less than 12 hours at this time of the year. But over 100 kilometers, or 62 miles, that can mean the fastest ones will come in 3 or 4 hours before the ones at the end. People started to stretch out at the third rest stop. One person cheerfully munched on a cardamom bun while some medics patched up her bloody knee. She said she crashed into a rotten log. The next bit of excitement on the trail was back at the fabled footbridge, some 30 feet above the rocks and ice of the Cascade River.
We're going to try to catch up with some skiers making their way across the bridge. Liam, take it from here.
All right, Raven.
That's my son, Raven, talking with his friend, Liam.
Hey, I'm Liam here with KVI, just wondering how you're feeling about the race.
All right, how about you? Having fun out?
Yeah. How are you feeling?
This sucks, but
how's it going?
How's it going? Good. 33K.
How's the snow looking?
The snow, it snowed, and people were delighted.
That last one there was Ingrid, our skiing reporter. This race also had 25-kilometer and 50-kilometer events. And by the middle of the day, those racers started intermingling on the trails with the 100-kilometer skiers. Raven and Liam and my other son, Tamarack, migrated up the hill to a little clearing in the woods where the shorter races started to finish on a sunny downhill that looked a bit like a mountain bike trail. They were lured into announcing results.
Go, Molly! Mollyos!
Louder, louder.
Let's go, Molly!
Here comes Molly.
124.
Let's go get an interview. Oh, he's gone.
Okay, we are here at the finish line. You know, we got some spectators gathered around. It's been a little bit slow. Usually it's been around 10 minutes between people that are finishing the race.
Liam caught up with the winner of the 50-kilometer race, Kenneth Rip.
It seemed like it was going to start as like a real adventure race because of this section, this last section, and then having to take your skis off and run over the ice. That was really exciting.
Yeah.
And then once we got on the track and then the snow started to come down, it was gorgeous and just skiing by, just serene out there.
For the other racers, temperatures started climbing and it made the fresh layer of snow start to stick to the bottom of lots of skis. This was a classic only race, not a skate skiing race, which means you ski in a running motion in parallel tracks, theoretically. It's March in Minnesota, so you ski on whatever surface you can find. About 2:30 in the now sunny afternoon, race director Allie Ricken was at the last major intersection where the racers either turned left to finish or went straight to do another 20-kilometer section.
I was just reading all the people that are, like, still unaccounted for.
Oh, how many are you missing?
Oh, no, I'm on the radio. Oh, a handful, but
I'm sure they'll turn up.
They'll turn up. They'll turn up. And if not, we'll go find them. Oh, here comes the skier. All right, Louis!
Straight ahead.
Where's the finish?
That way.
We reckoned our skiing reporter, Ingrid, should be coming up on about 80 kilometers at this point. I decided to ski up the hill to see if I could find her. I saw the skier with the bloody knee looking strong at about 79 kilometers.
It really does feel like we're in the mountains here, the way the sun hits the snow and the pine trees.
Woo! All right. Final lap or one more?
No, we're done, man. All right. Check this out.
So the weather, the sunlight, the snow, the feeling in the air, is that this should be a nice closing touch to the day, but some people still have to do this last 20-kilometer loop one more time, including this person.
Oh, no.
Oh, no?
You have to stay with me.
That reporter is faster than this one. Well, Ingrid did finish a couple hours later, about 30 minutes after dark, and just before a snowmobile sweeper came through. She was number 52 out of the 52 who finished, ages 16 through 63. The finish line scene was dark, maybe 10 people standing in the forest with headlamps, smiling, and expressing other emotions.
Oh my gosh, I feel like that should have been like easier than it was or something. Like my everything, I'm not going to be able to walk tomorrow, you guys.
Well, you did just ski 62 miles. With reporting assistance from Raven Broha, Liam McNiff, Tamarack Broha, and Ingrid Remack, for KFAI, I'm Paul Broha, Cascade River State Park, Minnesota.
You are listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. In the spring of 2024, the city of Detroit Lakes, Minnesota, partnered with artist Thomas Dambo to create a series of troll sculptures out of recycled materials. The trolls, each with their own unique persona, are spread out across Detroit Lakes, inviting visitors and residents to search for them. KFAI producer Armay Rivard spoke with Detroit Lakes residents who shared tips on where to find these trolls.
When I was a kid, my introduction to a troll was in the story from the Three Billy Goats Gruff. My children were introduced to three gruesome trolls in the Hobbit movie and the humongous troll in the Harry Potter series. All of these trolls were scary and mean. Now then, my grandkids will be introduced to some fun and friendly trolls thanks to Danish artist Thomas Dambo, who worked with the community of Detroit Lakes, Minnesota, and Project 412, which is a community-led nonprofit who sponsored the trolls and coordinated the 300 volunteers in May of 2024. The project consists of 9 sculptures, of which 5 are whimsical giant trolls, an immense golden rabbit, 3 portals, and 500 birdhouses. All constructed using recycled materials such as pallet wood, plastic containers, and loads of TLC. This art installation has a unique twist. The sculptures are located in different areas in and around Detroit Lakes, and visitors will have to decode riddles to find the trolls. How? By playing the trail game. There is a simple rule to follow. Don't disclose the location of the trolls. The artist wants all visitors to enjoy their troll hunting experience. Now then, I caught up with some local troll hunters to see how it works.
Hi, my name is Karen. The first one we found was really easy to find. Her name is Alexa, and she is nestled in the city park.
Like, we're supposed to keep it secret? No, that's right. Okay.
This is the only clue we're going to give you where the trolls are, because you will head to Alexa and you're going to find a book with riddles in it of where to find the next troll.
Karen Johnson of Brainerd, Minnesota, just shared where your journey begins. Detroit Lake City Park, where Alexis Elixir commands center stage with her spellbook of riddles. Now then, you need to decipher those riddles to find the location of the other trolls to go a troll hunting.
Hi everyone, I'm Diana. I did it a little differently. I went in cold. I wasn't listening to instructions. We kind of winged it. It was just a mystery to everybody in the area. We just kind of learned from word of mouth.
Now, troll hunters don't need to rely on the grapevine like Diana Snowgrove did. There's a variety of ways to see the trolls and a variety of trolls to meet, including Alexa, Ronnie Funny Face, Barefoot Frida, Jacob Everear, and Longleaf.
I'm very fortunate that we have this in our area. There are portals that you can find as well, ones at Roberts Alley, Holmes Theater, Becker County Museum, and Perm City Hall at Turtle Park.
According to the storyline, the portals are extensions of Alexis' arms, and her magical reach crosses into Fargo, North Dakota.
I have a granddaughter that's 9 that loves rabbits. On the last trip we made, our goal was to find the golden rabbit. and you're walking along and you cannot see these trolls. There's no evidence of where they are. It was a little harder to find than one would imagine. Like the name implies, it is gold, bright yellow, and it's made out of recycled plastic.
Now that I have found the secret location of these happy trolls, I can hardly wait to introduce them to my grandkids. I know they're going to love the adventure.
You've been listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. Support for Mini Culture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Mini Culture tab on the KFAI website at kfai.org/minneculture.
Listening to a radio station like no other. Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, supported by generous listener members just like you. So please do your part and what was the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Today's episode of Mini Culture Presents is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the good people of Minnesota. If you are enjoying today's stories, I strongly recommend that you subscribe to the Mini Culture Podcast, which you can find wherever you enjoy listening to your favorite podcasts. It is chock full of great art, history, and culture stories about our wonderful state. You can find it on SoundCloud and KFAI.org. Under the Mini Culture tab, you can also re-listen to, find, and share each of these stories that you've heard today individually on Mini Culture's SoundCloud page, soundcloud.com/miniculture. Coming up after the break, we continue presenting Mini Culture Year in Review 2025 right here on Mini Culture Presents in just a moment. Stick around.
Don't waste it. Recycle it.
Every pop can, every cardboard box, every hot sauce bottle counts.
That random junk mail, tomorrow's cereal box.
That glass bottle, next month's pickle jar.
That pop can, back on the shelf in just 60 days.
Don't waste it. Recycle it.
Because in Minneapolis, what goes around comes right back around.
What else should you recycle?
Search Minneapolis Recycling to learn more.
Support for KFAI comes from the Berlin Music Lounge, presenting Melvin Gibbs Thursday, January 15th. Writer, composer, and experimental musical artist, Melvin Gibbs will be doing a live remix of his latest release, Amasia Anamabia, Sessions 2, an amalgam of avant club, post-vaporwave prog, and jazz fusion. Melvin Gibbs lives his life in the jazz punk funk lane, taking inspiration from Miles Davis into the 21st century. More information about Melvin Gibbs at the Berlin Music Lounge is available at berlinmpls.com.
This is a test of the emergency alert system. If this were an actual emergency, the tones you just heard would be followed by information and further instructions. This concludes the test of the emergency alert system.
Seward Cafe is the longest-running, worker-owned and operated restaurant in the United States, serving up coffee and vegetarian and vegan food every Thursday through Sunday, 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., located at 2129 East Franklin Avenue in Minneapolis. Seward Cafe, no bosses since 1974.
Support for KFAI comes from the Dakota, presenting Hamilton de Holanda, Monday, January 26th. Brazilian bandolimist Hamilton de Holanda brings his 40 albums and counting career to the Dakota stage. He blends jazz and bossa nova with choro, the street music of Brasilia. Known for his improvisations and stage presence, Hamilton de Holanda has worked with some of the biggest names in jazz for over 40 years. More information about Hamilton de Holanda at the Dakota can be found at dakotacooks.com.
You are listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Compline has been observed by Benedictine monks since the 6th century. Compline is the closing service of the day, and it's filled with music, incense, candles, and communal prayer. It's a short but beautiful moment to let go of the day and prepare for the next. St. John the Evangelist Episcopal Church has been offering a Compline service every Thursday night, inviting people of all faiths to take part in its power. KFAI producer Allison Young shares this story.
It's 7 o'clock on a Thursday evening at St. John the Evangelist Episcopal Church in St. Paul. For Richard Gray, the director of music, this means one thing.
Incense. I personally love incense. The smell of it just brings me somewhere, and it lets me know we're at Compline.
Compline has been practiced by Benedictine monks for centuries. It's part of the daily office, or mini-services, that are chanted and sung at prescribed hours, giving a prayer-like rhythm to the day. Richard Gray finds Compline one of the most meaningful. Derived from the Latin word for completion, Compline is the final of the offices, a moment of stillness and reflection before resting at the end of the day.
When you walk in to a Compline service, you won't see all the lights turned on in the sanctuary. But you'll also see a lot of candles lit. And that's to have a bit of a certain inviting atmosphere where things are just a little bit more calm. There's a mystery to that.
At St. John's, the gathering is unlike any other regular church service. It's less a performance and more about simply being within the sound and the silence, as well as the mystery.
It's like a really hard thing for people to do right now.
It's a very hard thing for people to do right now. And that's one of the things I really like about this service, is that moment, or those moments of stillness that we have an opportunity to take part of in the midst of this so busy, totally busy life and all the noise that's around us. This service offers us a chance to put that aside and not be in that for a little while.
You're hearing the Mirandola Ensemble singing, a quartet that regularly provides music for Compline at St. John's. Their focus is on early music, which is mostly sung a cappella or without instrumental accompaniment. This type of ancient music is ideal for the Compline service because it's intimate with a mystical quality, according to the artistic director of the Mirandola Ensemble, Nick Chalmers.
It's all music that's produced by our bodies. In order for just one note or one chord to sound, everyone has to first of all be quiet and then all focus on the same thing, each other's breath. They all inhale together at the same time, ideally quietly. And then they all come in together at the exact same time, singing the exact same vowel in balance with one another, and they create a chord. I mean, just that, which occupies 1 second, that's like a miracle to me.
Compline has been practiced regularly since the 6th century and offers an intense feeling of peace that somehow we are not alone in life. But this hunger for peace, plus rest and trust, is not exclusive to the Christian faith. Jewish custom is to use the contemplative and focused prayer of Amida to close the day, while Muslims pray the Isha. But even the secular practice of counting up what we're grateful for before we sleep captures the spirit of Compline.
It's just a time where people that are not necessarily like-minded in the world can come together and experience something together that's beautiful and that's peaceful. And that, I think, was probably true 50 years ago and 500 years ago, but it seems especially true now.
While Compline is filled with singing and chanting, there is also a decisive period called the Great Silence. Signaled by a gong at its beginning and end, nothing is meant to happen in these 60 seconds but quiet and togetherness.
It's a very powerful moment. And one of the things I love is, you know, I close my eyes, but sometimes I'll open them briefly just to sort of look around the room, and especially to those who are coming for the first time, to see how they're experiencing this moment of silence.
Do not ask anxiously, what are we to eat? What are we to drink? What shall we wear? The whole world runs after such things. So do not be anxious about tomorrow. Today has enough problems of its own. Tomorrow can look after itself.
In Compline, participants recite together a statement to not worry about what comes next, because there are enough problems right now. This can mean a variety of things, depending on how you interpret it. Perhaps it's a call to have faith that things will work out, or a reminder that problems will always arise in life, so there's no use in worrying about them.
That text is sort of a grounding text for us to sort of sit in time and acknowledge that we have permission to leave things behind and start a new day tomorrow before we go to sleep and go to bed.
For KFAI, I'm Allison Young.
You've been listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. Support for Miniculture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on the KFAI website or go to kfai.org/minneculture.
Did you know that there are more than 300 public library branches in Minnesota? It takes a lot of people power to keep things running smoothly. Many of these libraries are supported by avid book lovers who volunteer as part of their library's friends group. KFAI producer R. May Rivard caught up with a group of retirees in Brainerd dedicated to the support of their local library.
Nearly every library I've been to has a book sale or two during the year. The proceeds from these sales help support all kinds of things at the library. I'm fairly certain these sales are staffed and run by people who love books, and these volunteers are the worker bees behind every successful sale. As a person who loves to read and support my favorite libraries by perusing any sale I find out about, I was curious about how all this worked. Well, I got a peek behind the curtain with the Friends of the Brainerd Public Library as they sorted and sniffed their way through loads of donated books in the receiving area behind the storefront located in the Westgate Mall up in Brainerd. Meet Judy Reardon.
I live in rural Brainerd. I became involved with Friends of the Brainerd Public Library, probably 25 years ago. One of the gals that I worked with volunteered with them, and it sounded interesting. So I began volunteering at their sales.
I had recently retired, and I wanted to do something with my time. I don't like to sew like I used to do. I don't know how to crochet, knit. So I just decided my love is reading books. I got involved, joined a book club with the Friends, and then found out about this book sale.
That's Karen Johnson, the current president of the Friends of the Brainerd Public Library.
My name is Mary Kalinowski, and I live in the Brainerd-Baxter area. I've been up here about 45 years. I'm a retired RN, worked mostly in the clinics, and I've been retired for about 10 years. So working as a friend of the Brainerd Public Library is one of my volunteer jobs and the one that I like more than anything else that I do. This is a group of people that gather every single Tuesday, and we sort through the books. And there are a ton of books that we get that are donated primarily by community members. My task is when the books come in, we open each box at a time and check the books over. So every book gets handled at least once. We check the cover, make sure it's in good condition. We sniff all our books. We're all good sniffers here. We want our books to smell good. We page through them, fan through them to make sure there's no leftover paperwork in the books that people use for bookmarks. So we occasionally find a letter or star receipts or bookmarks, that kind of thing. We have found money, and several hundred dollars once in cash, and we were able to track the source and give the gentleman his money back. We sort our books and put them in these tubs, and then we move the books from the tubs out into the main part of the store in the correct category.
Judy Reardon, and we would put the books out in preparation for the sale, and then during the sale we would take stacks of books from people and take them up to the checkout table so they wouldn't have to lug all those books around with them. We are located in the Westgate Mall. The mall has been extremely generous to us, giving us space for, probably about 10 years. And for the last 5 or so years, we have been located in the same spot, which allowed us to set up as though we were having a book sale. And when we would sort the books, we would just put them out on the tables. And that has really been a lifesaver, saves a lot of time.
Sounds like a workout.
It is. Tuesday is our donation day. So we are here from 9 to 3, and they bring them to the service door of the store that we're located in at the Westgate Mall. About 97% of our books are donated from the public, and the other 3% are ones that the library has cleaned out. We have two pallets end-to-end in our service area in the back. It is not uncommon for those pallets to be empty on a Tuesday morning and be completely filled with boxes of books by the time we leave at 3 o'clock.
Most libraries have a Friends of Fill in the Blank Public Library that really do this. They walk alongside their library and say, how can we help you? What can we do? With that money that we raise, it all goes back into our library for what we call kind of the icing on the cake. We don't determine what we should buy. We look to the librarian, and our librarian looks to the staff and says, what do we need? The Friends group wants to donate. What can we use? So our overall goal is to truly support our library with whatever needs they have, and then also support that love of reading.
The dedication of these gals was impressive. It was more work than I would have ever thought went into sorting books. And now I know who to ask to recommend the next Minnesota author for me to read.
Thanks for listening. Support for Miniculture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on kfai.org. This is 10,000 Fresh Voices, a project of Miniculture. I'm your host, Erica Janik. Every Tuesday night, Choir Walk With Me gathers to practice. The small group sings a diverse mix of songs and prides itself on celebrating the esoteric and weird. KFAI's Angela Lundberg brings us the story.
It's a Tuesday night, and Choir Walk With Me is doing its warm-up vocals. The group's name is a play on the David Lynch film Fire Walk With Me, and they sing all kinds of songs, from classic crooners to indie rock. Choir Walk With Me is a small choir comprised of about 15 singers based out of South Minneapolis. But this is not your average choir. Its oddball songs and diverse members redefine what a choir is expected to sound and be like.
When you motor away, beyond the what's your lips, when you free yourself from the chance of a lifetime.
Peter Hogan has led the choir since February 2024. With an extensive musical background, Hogan chooses a unique mix of songs and does all of the arrangements himself.
We sing a wide variety of stuff, going from Dean Martin and Roy Orbison to, we did a Rihanna song last year. We've done Magnetic Fields, Cher, Joanna Newsom, and The Fall, and it's all just stuff that I like. I have kind of eclectic tastes. I take a little bit of input from people, but as we say at the beginning of each season, this is not a democracy, which is funny, sort of, hopefully.
Even if it's not a democracy, so to speak, the choir members definitely have songs they like to perform as a group. Maggie Hogan's favorite song is Masterpiece by Big Thief.
It's one that makes a lot of people cry, but it is just beautiful and it's lovely to sing.
Jane Hornsby also.
I think there's a ritual element to it. Like sometimes art makes us emotional and there's tears and we hug each other and sometimes it makes us laugh and we're just kind of together through all of the emotions, and I think that that's really powerful.
On the opposite side of sad, teary ballads, Amy Wilkerson prefers more upbeat songs.
Well, I really liked when we sang Tip City by the Amps, and I like songs that we can scream more and kind of get things out. There's a lot of anxieties in the world now, and it's kind of a therapy.
Wilkerson first joined another choir years ago in the midst of a deep depression, but singing helped her recover.
Oh, I find joy in this choir. It's silly, it's kinky, it's sassy.
The Busting Stars said it was good. Whoa, 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 whoa.
In addition to the whoops and hollers of songs like Tip City, everyone in Choir Walk With Me agrees that there's something more meaningful at work than just having fun and blowing off steam. This is Jess Buns.
I've had a lot of mental health struggles, and it's been a good place for me to turn when I'm feeling down, and I know that I have people who have my back and love me and like want me to succeed, and singing is just so good for my overall well-being.
But what if you're afraid you can't sing? Director Peter Hogan, who is lovingly nicknamed Choir Daddy, says that doesn't matter.
And I don't really want to audition people. I don't want it based on skill. I want it more based on personality. And if they can sing well, that's a bonus. But I'd rather have people sound a little rough around the edges, but enthusiastic than super polished and classically trained.
Joining a choir is also a great way to try something new and get out of your comfort zone. Maggie Hogan found a way to do just that.
I decided to join choir because it was a whole new thing for me, and it kind of fires up a whole different side of my brain. I'm used to having very, very sporty type hobbies, and this is just something that allows me to express myself in a whole different way.
Despite having a musical background, dating back to childhood. Jane Hornsby says they still struggle with insecurities.
I'm from a very musical family, but I've always been insecure about my own musical abilities. But doing it with a group makes me feel like the stakes are lower and I can have fun with it and just sing, which I really enjoy.
Jess Buns adds,
I consider us a family. I don't know if every choir feels like a family, but this one certainly does, and I'm really grateful for it.
Whenever the choir members part ways after practice or a performance, you could say that reuniting again is often just like they never said goodbye. This is Angela Lundberg for KFAI Radio.
You've been listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Support for Miniculture is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on kfai.org.
Find and hear that story and everything you've heard here today again at Miniculture's SoundCloud page, soundcloud.com/miniculture. In fact, you can easily share these stories with your pals from there too, which I bet you're anxious to do. I know how you feel. This Miniculture work is made to be shared and get the word out about our unique and vibrant Minnesota community. The Miniculture SoundCloud page is a great way to keep tabs on their latest work and also under the Miniculture tab on KFAI. And while you're there at KFAI, please consider clicking the donate button. You can help keep all these great Miniculture stories coming and the Miniculture gears churning by supporting KFAI, Miniculture's radio home. Please do consider becoming a sustaining member of KFAI today. KFAI continues to operate with your support, and it is truly people-powered public radio, and we need you now more than ever. Now that our beloved Corporation for Public Broadcasting is gone. This has been Miniculture Presents. My name is Michael Whetstone, and you are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in the Twin Cities. Support for Miniculture is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. We will be back here again next week, Monday at 1 o'clock, with more great Miniculture stories as we continue our year in review for 2025. Until then, let's flip to the upside down.